this would not be a threat to people's freedom or lead to tyranny or genocide. And the problem is the Democrats have been trying to see what they can get past, as opposed to taking a long-term strategic approach to challenging the propaganda that's been put out by the NRA for 40 years. Because the difference between the United States and New Zealand and Australia is the fact that we have the NRA, and even as the NRA is going down, it's their ideology that remains. And that's what hasn't been challenged. And the entire leadership of the GOP has bought into this ideology. So that has to be challenged. I don't think an assault weapons ban is going to happen under this administration, not unless the Democrats do extremely well in the midterms. Yes, removing the filibuster would eliminate a barrier, but the Republicans could come up with other ways to impede legislation. And the problem is the Democrats have finally gotten to the point where they've put real gun reform on the table, but we're still years away from getting there.
Frank Smyth, we want to thank you so much for being with us, longtime investigative journalist, author of The NRA, The Unauthorized History. Democracy Now! Is currently accepting applications for senior news producer. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
Here, flowers are blooming, new buds are on the trees, and that means it's time for the KBOO Grateful Dead and Friends Spring Marathon. The Grateful Dead and Friends hosts have been scouring their vaults to share 7 hours of choice and rare recordings with you. Tune in and turn it up on Saturday, April 3rd, from noon to 7 p.m. as your Grateful Dead and Friends hosts bring you great music, fun insights, and a gentle reminder to support your community-powered radio station, KBOO Portland.
Has a number of special t-shirts we've created just for you during our month of special programming. Whether you are a metalhead, a punk rocker, a bluegrass fan, or a feminist, we have a t-shirt for you. Wear it proudly in support of KBOO Community Radio. Go to kboo.fm/t-shirts to see all the designs. All proceeds go to support the work of KBOO Community Radio.
This is KBOO Portland. It's 8:01. It's Wednesday. It's time for a Wednesday talk radio program with your host, Paul Rowland. Stay tuned.
Hold your head up. Lift the top of your mind. Put your eyes on the earth. Lift your heart.
And good morning, everybody. This is Paul Rowland, and this is Wednesday Talk Radio here on your community radio station, KBOO, listener-sponsored, listener-supported, 50-plus years old and going strong. So I'm sure anybody who's listening to KBOO, paying attention to the news, knows that there has been, as a certainly part of Trump's legacy, but much deeper, a rising wave of violence and violent rhetoric and harassment of Asian Americans, including here in Portland, most prominently a string of breaking of windows of businesses, Asian American businesses, but not only. I think some people confuse some businesses with being Asian owned. But in any case, there's a that happened in early February. But there's also been harassment and overt violence against people on the streets, people being pushed, shoved. Anyway, we're going to explore all that with the policy director of the Asian Pacific American Network of Oregon, APANO, Richa Poudal, who joins us this morning by phone. Good morning, Richa.
Morning, Paul. Thank you for having me this morning.
You're quite welcome. We're also in the aftershock of two mass shootings now. So these things seem to come fast and furious. But we're going to take a deep dive into the history and current manifestation of anti-Asian racism. So first of all, why don't you, since I didn't introduce you, I'll just briefly say you're a first-generation Nepali-American, a community organizer, and as I said, policy director at APANO. Maybe talk a little bit about yourself, how you and your family came to be in the United States in Portland, and then some about APANO.
Yeah, sure. So like you said, my family actually is from Nepal. I'm first generation, and so my parents immigrated here to the U.S. in the 80s in sort of a classic South Asian pursuit of higher education, more opportunity. Nepal and Kathmandu, where they're from, is pretty poverty-stricken, but also just very limited jobs in a number of different fields. And I think my dad was the first in his family to go to college, and he did that in India, and then came out here to do his master's, mostly just in pursuit of making enough money to send back home to his parents and his siblings. My immigration story, or how I ended up in the U.S., does my parents did have choice in arriving here, and that's kind of credit to the Black Lives Civil Rights Movement that allowed for the reversal of a lot of anti-immigration policies that were in place in the U.S. In the 1920s to 1940s.
Were they specifically Asian exclusionary or more broadly?
A lot of them did explicitly identify Asian communities, as being excluded, yeah. I think a lot of times when we talk about for a lot of Asian stories of immigration, I know not all of them had the same level of choice that my parents did, but they really were only able to happen because of Black-led struggles that had other communities in mind through the Civil Rights Movement, yeah.
In fact, as we move into talking about your work with APANO, we talked yesterday on the phone briefly, and what you're saying, it strikes me that there's probably really different, you know, obviously there's individuals within each community that are different, but mm-hmm. as a whole, there's probably very different stories in terms of where people came from, how, you know, like for example. Mm-hmm. Vietnamese refugees were kind of a unique story, and I'm sure also Laotian and Cambodian, mm-hmm. which are probably different from the story you're telling.
Mm-hmm, absolutely, yeah. So APANO is Pano Asian Pacific American Network of Oregon. So it feels definitely conflicting sometimes to be working with an organization where we have Asian in the name, and we're internally also needing to grapple with, are we sort of who are we able to represent as one organization, but really hoping to be an organization that provides space for Asians and Pacific Islanders of various backgrounds to come together and build power, to develop leaders, and advance equity in our communities. We do that through community organizing. We do that through policy advocacy. We do community development work and place-based work and also cultural and arts work, and sort of just wanting Pano, I think, like, intends to be a hub here locally for folks to come and envision with us a more just world where API folks and communities who share our aspirations and struggles that we're in solidarity with have all the power and resources and voice for kind of self-determination.
And about how long has Pano been around?
Pano has been around for almost 15 years. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And it's evolved a lot. It was definitely, we're the biggest that we've ever been as an organization. We started as, I think, maybe like a four-person organization, and have grown to about 35 folks today. And I'm new to Pano as staff, but I have been a Pano member as long as I've lived in Portland and gone through a lot of the leadership development programming and training that the organization offers. So I've built a lot of my political analysis in community with folks at Pano. And in my current role as policy director, I actually focus on issues of climate justice, working to sort of empower and learn alongside APIs in our community in a way where we're pushing for policies here that bring us into a world that just values people and planet over profit, especially as we assess that our current economy is not prioritizing the care of people and planet and kind of strategizing on making that shift.
Yeah, I remember now that those times before COVID, which seem sort of distant in a way, when there was in the street activism. I remember there was, I think, Pano played a big role in the at least one climate march that I participated in, and just seemed to be something kind of developing that Pano was a big part of, and hopefully those days will return again. But anyway.
Yeah, I hope so too. Yeah, we're really trying to tap into, and I think a lot of our friends and neighbors here in Portland and Oregon who come from any sort of like diaspora around the world, just like tapping into what our respective ancestors knew about like right relationship with the earth. So that there's something very, I think, valuable about us coming together within our communities and exploring that and using that to drive the work. But yeah, can't wait to do that in person a little bit more. We're working on some policies at the state level right now, but it's all virtual. It's very new and missing a lot of the connection and the marching together and walking. Yeah.
So give us something of an introduction to the Asian American community before we, you know, we get into some of this sort of the dark side of American racist treatment of Asian immigrants as part of a general pattern of white supremacy in this country. But you know, I mentioned Vietnamese, obviously. You know, Chinese were here from the very beginning, working certainly on the railroads and others. And give us a little overview of who is part of the Pano network.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and I've been thinking about like how it's so the Asian community here and across the country is so big and beautiful and diverse, and it's, I think, in the light of recent attacks and also sort of the Trump Trump rhetoric that we've been under this last few years. We haven't gotten a chance in the public to really celebrate the diverseness of our Asian communities. In Oregon, our largest populations are Chinese Americans, Filipino Americans, Japanese Americans, Vietnamese Americans, Indian Americans, and Korean Americans. But like you said, we have, you know, folks from Laos, we have the Hmong community, we have Pacific Islander communities from a diversity of islands who may have made their way through Hawaii here. We have refugees here in Oregon from a number of countries. I know we have a significant population of Bhutanese refugees right now. We also, you know, want to name that we have folks who are a part of multiple identities at once. So we have Black Asians, we have Muslim Asians, we have Latinx Asians. It's Asian is a very broad term, and I think definitely a lot of the work that we do at Apano, when people are using data to sort of identify funding and policy priorities, we're always pushing for like a very disaggregated assessment of the data, because we just have a really beautiful, diverse community of Asian Americans here. Some of us are immigrants. Some of us are first generation. Some of us are here with our own businesses and plan to remain here. Some of us are here in school. And so just wanting to name that the diversity, just like with any, it's so hard to like talk about an entire continent of people succinctly and sort of uplift all of those experiences and histories, but
not to mention all the islands and archipelagos, which are numerous. I mean, think of Indonesia, which is a vast, vast area. Anyway, the people think of East Portland. I actually live on the east side of 82nd, so I, you know, on a daily basis, actually do encounter a fair number of Asian American people, and so I'm, you know, oh, and plus I, you know, I go through the Jade District, which is there at, I guess, centered at Division and 82nd. So I guess people think that obviously the community must be spread out all over Portland and the surrounding areas. But so I'm just kind of interested, just came to mind, the history of that must be mainly a Chinese American history, is how it came to be kind of centered in that area.
Yeah, so when my understanding is that Chinese Americans that came to the States to work on the railroad were eventually sort of kicked out of different areas of California, and that's how a lot of them ended up in Oregon, mostly settling along the Willamette Valley, closer to the river, but over time have just been displaced, which is, you know, similar to the Black community in Portland. We see a much larger population of both Black and Chinese Americans out in East Portland than there once was.
So since I mentioned the Jade District and this question, the topic of the show, unfortunately, is this wave of harassment in a historical context. We can get into deeper into the history, obviously the Chinese exclusion laws and the really kind of vicious exploitation of Chinese labor and the Japanese internment. I was curious what your reaction and people's reaction was to that wave of vandalism that happened in early February, and maybe talk about other incidents that maybe people haven't even heard about.
So thank you for uplifting that. So in February, I think we had about 11 Asian-owned businesses that had their windows smashed in the span of a month here in Portland. And I think that while there's not any direct evidence that the vandalism was motivated by racism, given kind of like our current political context and what's happening across the country. It feels very jarring, and it feels very, I think in the last year, people are feeling like a lot of the harm that's always been caused by language, by sort of racist and violent language against a variety of Asian Americans, is just like manifesting instantly in harm. We've had a lot of, in addition to the vandalism of those businesses, there, as you mentioned earlier, there have been a number of physical assaults in Portland itself against Asian Americans. I have a couple. There's one in December at a train stop near Interstate in Lombard, where an Asian American male was punched in the face after being asked, "Are you Chinese?" There was another one in January where this was actually against a Muslim employee at a gas station in Southeast Portland, where this person was yelled about "you unholy immigrants, Bin Laden, Al Qaeda." Someone threw items, objects from the store at this victim and followed them behind the counter. There was another incident on a TriMet bus in January as well, with an Asian woman and her teenage son, with someone yelling, "All Chinese people have a virus," and gave it to us, and kicked both of them in the shins. It's just, it's very, I think, what we're hearing from our Asian community members are that they're feeling unsafe knowing where these attacks are happening. They're happening at bus stops, at convenience stores, just places that we're, you know, during the pandemic, there are like few places where we can really go. And these are places people have to go to maintain their daily lives, to be able to work, to be able to take care of their kids and their elders. And people are feeling afraid to leave their home. And people are feeling distrustful of the community around them. I mean, I think it's just fear. It's like the same thing that I think a lot of non-white people feel. In Portland, in Oregon, in places that even before these attacks happened, I think that sense of fear has been activated by living in a state where we know there are people here around us who don't want not white people to be in their neighborhoods or in their homes. Yeah,
you know,
a lot of
one
fear.
Thing that I don't know why this particular thing bothers me so much, but just the idea that people are attacking anybody who they think looks Asian, which is such a, you know, it's absurd on the face of it. But then just assuming people are Chinese, I don't know. Just the ignorance behind it all is really astounding to me. But I guess that's part of the American psychology, I guess.
Yeah, and I mean, I think it does uplift, like, something we see a lot is, like, in the way that people jokingly are racist against Asian Americans, a lot of that is, like, conflating Chinese Americans with other Asian identities. It's not funny, obviously, because that conflation, in addition to sort of all of these other ways that we, I don't know, the way that I remember, like, growing up, like, kids are always making fun of Asian names, just like these sort of, like, there's been such a, like, mockery in the way that people talk about Asian Americans and interact with Asian Americans. And I'm hoping that by now it feels clear that that just isn't funny. Yeah.
So let me just reintroduce you. This is a Wednesday Talk Radio, and I'm the regular weekly host, Paul Rowland. I'm speaking with Richa Poudal, who's the policy director of the Asian Pacific American Network of Oregon, APANO. And we are talking generally about the Asian American community in Portland and beyond, and specifically this increase in a pattern of harassment and violence, assaults, and rhetoric, including some actual hate crimes, although we know that hate crimes are notoriously, I guess, difficult or rare to be prosecuted. But I did read that in Multnomah County, since the beginning of 2020, Asian American victims reported the second highest number of race-related bias crimes. That's definitely a strong uptick, and it matches what's going on around the country. I know that you all had a rally just a few days ago as part of a nationwide, and this is specifically reacting to the vicious murders that happened in Atlanta that we you know don't know the full story of, but it seems on the face of it, since they were almost all Asian American women, that had something to do with gender and had something to do with their race. But talk about that rally, and then more generally, what you know, what you're looking for maybe from the broader community in terms of support.
Yeah. So you know, I'll say that APANO is the only, I think, nonprofit in town that focuses on the Asian American community here. But there are a number of other Asian American leaders and community groups that we are in close communication with and work with. And we sort of supported a community rally and vigil this weekend that was really just honoring and grieving the lives of the women who died in Atlanta and were murdered. And I think, you know, it's been overwhelming. I think in some ways, because anti-Asian hate and violence hasn't been in the sort of front of mind or in the news quite as much. We're not used to receiving this much attention or sort of like asks for support. And we're, I think, like at least the week following the Georgia attacks, we really had to just ask people to give us a little bit of time as an organization to take care of each other and sort of pause. It feels challenging to when something really tragic and really traumatic happens, to then just be able to bounce back and make all these demands or put together materials for people who want to help. And so really holding, I think right now, like wanting to be able to ask for support from other community members at this time, but also needing to hold the space to grieve and be in community with each other. Mm-hmm. We are certainly kind of getting, while we appreciate the support ourselves as orgs, we are responding to some of our members themselves. So we have had members reach out and let us know about different either hate speech or threats that they've been experiencing. And so we've been trying to sort of just tend to those as much as we can first. We're also in contact with folks on the ground in Atlanta to kind of be connected to the fundraising efforts that are happening locally there for the families themselves who have lost somebody, and also for sort of, the organizations that work in the intersection of Asian American advocacy, but also sex workers and sex worker rights, because we know that these sort of attacks are really playing out on the most marginalized members, even members of our community, even within the Asian American community. There's more events happening, and I think that like following us on Instagram to keep track of those, we've been trying to uplift them, whether we're putting them on or another group is. I would just kind of encourage people to take time to grieve. I think that we often feel like when something terrible happens, we have to jump into action, and there's just a lot of I feel like a lot of the process of feeling what has happened is lost. And so I think that's kind of the phase that we're in right now.
Mm-hmm. I have yet to mention that this is actually a listener call-in show. I'm sure most of you already know that, and some of you may even know the number. But let me give that number. It's 503-231-8187, 503-231-8187. You might want to get your calls in somewhat sooner rather than later. Don't wait till 5 minutes till, I guess is what I'm saying. And this is Wednesday Talk Radio here on your community radio station, KBOO. I'm speaking with Richa Pudal of the Asian Pacific American Network of Oregon, APANO. And we're talking about the Asian American community in Portland and beyond, and its history. And so, yeah, let's talk about the continuing just drumbeat, the numbing murders of mostly young African American men by police is. And the strong righteous reaction to that under the Black Lives Matter banner has taken hold both among progressives here in Portland. There's certainly been a huge upsurge in activism around that, but also in terms of reaction by the right in terms of sort of blaming Black Lives Matter for everything that they don't like in the United States. And in some ways, other communities sort of have gone somewhat under the radar. Obviously, it's such a complex history of the total expropriation and wars against Native Americans who lived here for thousands of years, developing very rich, complex societies that became so largely undone in so many places, but thankfully not completely. And so there, and then the importation of African people to run the plantation economy, and then basically create the foundation for the wealth of the United States. And of course, then Asian Americans became part of that with the Chinese Americans. And then, it's just such a complex history. But what's your understanding of, I guess more in general, what is APANO's sort of political analysis of how they fit into the sort of the American historical framework? I know that's a huge... huge question. I don't know.
Yeah.
Answer it however you want.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think that APANO is striving to operate from a place where we recognize just like how much harm is happening right now to so many communities. And like I said, I don't think APANO is particularly used to getting so much coverage around anti-Asian hate. A lot of what we've been striving for in this, especially since the uprising last summer, is really standing in solidarity with our Black and Indigenous colleagues and community members who have been doing sort of intense organizing work around racial violence for so long, and have had to both carry the pain of all the loss and also the resilience and strength to keep leading on the work. And so I think we've, you know, up until recently have been really focused on that solidarity work, doing our own learning and educating within our Asian communities, because there are certainly very strong anti-blackness sentiments and systems at play in a lot of Asian communities. And my own, for South Asians, I think, you know, I'm doing a lot of learning around, you know, what are the systems that keep Black folks oppressed in the U.S. and the histories, and how are they also similar to the caste system that's prevalent in my community. So just, I think we really are trying to do this work together. Like I mentioned in the beginning, of just sort of where my family comes from and how it was possible for them to even come here, just wanting to remain in the practice of crediting Black struggles that have paved the way for different privileges that Asian Americans, some Asian Americans, enjoy today. And they've also, you know, the Black community leaders that we've worked with are also showing up for us in this time. They're reaching out to us. They're making sure that when they talk about racial violence, if they weren't already talking about it in a nuanced way with capturing all the racial violence that can happen towards any group, that we're doing more of that. And then I think the other piece is that the Apano is still learning, but is moving in the direction of really, really learning about transformative justice and what that could look like in our systems around us. Because I think even when this pain is caused to our Asian communities, we are not interested in seeing our Black and Indigenous friends being, you know, being at the brunt of police brutality by including, by increasing police presence in some of these spaces, or increasing police attention on some of these issues. And so we're really still committed to exploring and practicing and learning what community safety really looks like without the systems that we know harm Black and Indigenous folks the most. So just doing all this work in a way that is not sacrificing anybody, because if we're putting any other of our community members at risk, whose liberation is inherently tied with ours, then it doesn't really feel like we're doing the right work.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up, because first of all, let me just give the phone number again, since we haven't had any callers. I invite people to call in. We've got only about 20 minutes left, 503-231-8187. But I'm glad you brought that up about the police, because actually I just started talking just by myself. I was solo last week, and I was talking about this issue, and someone actually asked me what I thought, you know, we could do in general, which is kind of an overly broad question, but I mentioned, you know, there was GoFundMe accounts for the businesses that were targeted, and of course, you know, in the COVID atmosphere, most people are already kind of marginal, so I'm sure that hit especially hard. So anyway, there was a GoFundMe. I said people could, you know, frequent those businesses that were attacked to kind of show their direct support. Mm-hmm. And then they got on the subject of the police, and a caller mentioned that, you know, they didn't think that that was such a great idea for, you know, to call for more police there. And I responded that I mean, not knowing, but I figured there must be a diversity of opinion, let us say, in the different Asian American communities on the subject of the police. And then I'll just add in, I imagine there are probably some generational differences as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think the differences that we see on sort of how to include or not include police in our lives and in dealing with these attacks is definitely varies in the Asian American community, just as it does kind of across the board. I think we see that it varies in the Black community, it varies in amongst white people, and so we do definitely have that similar, you know, there are definitely Asian American community members in our in Portland who are calling the police, who are would like to see more police presence to help them feel safe. And I think APANO is, we're as an organization, we're in a place where it has been, we can of course we can understand, like, when you were put in harm's way, that it is, we want to seek the thing that is going to make us feel safe. And we have been sort of taught that the police are that thing. But we just know that, we know that not only do the police not keep us safe, I don't know if you saw that in Georgia, the Georgia attacks, there was a Latino man, Mario Gonzalez, who survived the attacks, and the police had him in handcuffs for 2 hours while his wife bled to death. Yeah, and the police, you know, thought he was a suspect, and then later when they identified the real shooter, that white man was escorted out so safely. It just, like, the police are obviously not keeping us safe in this racist system. And we, you know, even though it's not happening at the rate that it is for our Black community, there has definitely been killing of community members, Asian community members, with disabilities by the police in our country. So it's just, we know that is not the system that has been keeping us safe. And we know that it's hard because we haven't fully created the system we want to keep us safe. I'm sure it's come up on this show or elsewhere, just the rollout of programs locally, like the Portland Street Response and Lens. But we're really hoping that APANO can be a part of training folks up to feel confident in interrupting situations that might feel harmful. I think that's probably an ask that we have of allies and supporters, is there are sort of a rise of bystander intervention trainings that are being offered in our community. If that would help us feel more able to sort of, if something like this happened on the bus, or someone's being yelled at or kicked, but we're able to have some tools around de-escalating that situation. Just want to name that certainly in the Asian American community, we hold all of the different viewpoints. There's no monolithic stance on police within Asian Americans.
That's interesting, that the bystander intervention trainings, and you mentioned the Portland Street Response. I know that there's been, you know, attempts to have, I have a vague memory of this, but I think there's some African American group actually had people sort of going on like TriMet and stuff at some point as
rider advocates.
There you go.
Yeah.
That's sort of along those similar lines. And let me just throw one more thing. I had mentioned this to you in our phone call yesterday that, you know, another thing I kind of blabbed out on the air last week was, well, you know, during the, you know, 67, 68, when the Black Panther Party and the American Indian Movement formed, they were both basically, you know, street response against specifically police violence. So, of course, this is something very different. Plus, it's, you know, it's kind of in some ways amorphous. You know, obviously, no one claimed those vandalisms. Obviously, if someone is attacked, mm-hmm. and the perpetrator is identified, you know who they are. But usually it's, you know, it's not part of a pattern, whereas, you know, police mistreatment has been a long time pattern, and you can often identify the specific individuals and the way that the institution, condones or reinforces or allows that to happen. And so there's like something specific to fight against. It's hard. You know, I don't know. I heard something about like maybe the Proud Boys having attacked some businesses a couple weeks ago or something. But it would be hard to form something like that against, you know, these sort of really threats. It could come from anywhere, really.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's true. Although I do think, you know, I think the intention of some of these sort of like community safety approaches is that we are able to look out for each other and be a part of each other's safety. And so I think it's almost like it feels a little bit like mutual aid in some ways, like in ways that like even those, you know, street response is government funded, but it. Those kinds of things are already happening in community with our members. We're seeing people offer to provide meals for people who have been made to feel unsafe because of any sort of anti-Asian hate or violence, offering for people, like people are raising money to help folks relocate if they feel like they're unsafe in their home right now because of any threats that they've been facing. And so just sort of this like community-centered support where you're really approaching the person who's been harmed with how can we make sure you're feeling more safe right now than you are. And getting the resources from other community members and organizing that to even create like temporary periods of safety, because I think you're right, like when it's not specifically the police and when it's folks at large, it's hard to feel safe anywhere. But that is also our current reality, is that like it is not safe here for Black and brown people and for Asian Americans and honestly for anyone who isn't white.
So you're encouraging people not to go out alone, say?
Yeah, I mean, I think we're offering support that folks want. And so I think we're offering that. We've had people reach out to us and offer sort of to like walk folks places if that would be helpful to them. And I think for some people that does feel like it would feel a little bit safer if someone could walk them to the store and back, and just not be traveling alone. I think it gets tricky to just like ask people to do things that are so limiting their lives. Then everyone has different senses of what makes them feel safe. So just wanting to be as customized as possible for the people's safety.
Mm-hmm. Oh, looks like we finally do have a phone caller. Once again, 503-231-8187. I'm speaking with Richa Poudal of the Asian Pacific American Network of Oregon, APANO. And you are welcome to call in. We only have a few minutes left, so you better get your calls in soon. But Harry is on the line. Go ahead, Harry.
Oh, good morning, and thank you for taking my call. I want to thank your organization for helping the Black Lives Matter organization, because here in Oregon, the black population is really a minority. In fact, there's only 77,000 black people in the state of Oregon. But there's 194,000 Oregonians with Asian descent. And the issues we hear on the news about gentrification, about how black families are being forced to move, you know, from mostly northeast Portland to southeast Portland. Does the Asian community have the same problem of gentrification, or what areas they live in the Portland area?
That's a really good question. Thank you, Harry. Yeah, I think we have different histories. So I think just naming that the Black community in Portland has had a very specific history of institutions of the city and Prosper Portland without the consent of families that have lived in North Portland for generations, doing development that has pushed Black folks out of their homes and out into East Portland. I think with Asian American community, we definitely have as we mentioned, just a diversity of who falls into that category. And so I can say, for example, myself, I'm South Asian. I've lived in Portland just not too long, just maybe over 5 years. I'm class privileged. My parents are middle, upper middle class. And so my experience is not going to be the same as folks who have been displaced, but there are certainly, as I mentioned earlier in the segment, especially the Chinese American population that came to Oregon through California, that was a clear example of an Asian American community that had been settling pretty close in Portland and has been displaced out east of 82nd. And then we also see, we have a pretty, Multnomah County has the largest Asian American population in Oregon, but Washington County is a close second. So we do see a significant Asian community out there, although also nuanced because I can't say that everyone has been displaced. Certainly folks have also moved out there and chosen to live there. So yeah, I do think we have similar histories, but I do want to make it distinct that for the Black community, folks were really rooted in their neighborhoods and want to honor that history as not being the exact same experience for Asian Americans.
Americans were forced to live in North Portland, Northeast Portland. And
yeah.
So I understand what you were saying about the history. But, hey, thank you for taking my call.
Yeah,
and thank you, Harry. Always good to hear from you. And now that Harry is gone from the line is open. We only have, because me and Richa are occupying one whole set of the phone system, there's only one line open for callers, so you now have a line open, 503-231-8187. But gosh, time has disappeared really quick. We only have about 8 minutes left, so get your call in right now. So I don't know, from my experience living between 82nd and I-205, kind of in the general Burnside area. I don't know. There's definitely a number of Asian American families within a few blocks of me. I don't know where, there's a larger concentration. But I can see the writing on the wall as gentrification. It kind of slowed down because of the 2008 crash, and I don't know the ins and outs of the housing market. But anyway, you can, I've seen an uptick of houses for sale in my neighborhood. It's just inevitable that it's sort of as those most desirable neighborhoods sort of get consolidated by wealthier people, then, it sort of has a knock-on effect and kind of pushes people. And so, I don't know. I don't know how much has actually happened, how much is happening, but it does seem like it's definitely these areas are not immune from the same processes that affected the rest of Portland.
Yeah, no, absolutely, absolutely. Yeah, I think displacement of different BIPOC communities is happening kind of at a daily pace. And we are seeing, I think that, for Arpano, we work so closely with a lot of the businesses in East Portland and just sort of also working on advocating for funding for our neighborhoods in East Portland that have been so disinvested in. And so even in cases where maybe we're not addressing the direct displacement, we are trying to sort of do the work to make sure that where folks are now is as safe as parts of the city that are more white.
Mm-hmm. So is there anything we haven't... I just to follow up really quickly on what we were talking about earlier in the police and the threats, has there been any... I mean, have you received actual verbal threats to Opano? Is there any identifiable sort of source, political source for what's going on? Or is it, as I said, just there's really no way of knowing?
Yeah, I think besides the instances we talked about, we haven't had any sort of like identified sources. We've heard things from our community members that I'm not sure that I'm able to speak about here, but that have largely been anonymous, sort of like anonymous threats, anonymous racist language and notes. And so I think the priority right now has just been really anyone who's been experiencing this within our networks, making sure that they have what they need to sort of feel a little bit safer.
So would you refer people to Opano who may have had something happen? And
So I think there's a couple different things. Like we know that we need that these sorts of incidents are not reported at a high rate, and so we are encouraging folks to report. We're a part of the Portland United Against Hate coalition that has a report www.reporthatepdx.com, where in Portland you can report hate instances. But you know, we didn't even really offer as an organ. We're like still grieving, and I think we just started receiving requests from people who have experienced this. And so, as a community hub, absolutely, if somebody is experiencing hate or fear, please reach out. We're doing whatever we can to sort of pull resources from our allies, from our org itself, to support people in whatever way they need. And I guess I'll just say in general, you know, the things that we've been sort of like asking for when people ask us how they can support us is, like I mentioned before, really taking the time to grieve and honor the lives of those folks who died in Atlanta, supporting some of these community-based response programs like Portland Street Response. That program was not easy to manifest, and so the expansion of that program or additional programs like it will also take a lot of advocacy to make happen. I think we're asking folks to really, like, in their anti-racist education and work, include just expanded definitions of racial violence and racism, and acknowledge that different communities experience oppression differently, but that it's all violent and it all is able to take place under white supremacy. You mentioned sort of supporting the businesses in the J District that have been targeted or vandalized by just supporting their business and ordering from them. Reporting whether an instance is happening to you or it's happening to someone around you. I think, like, we see that, while there are definitely spaces in our country where people are still not convinced that something like Atlanta was racially charged, I think having the data to back it up definitely helps in kind of getting resources to where they need to go.
Portland United Against Hate website again?
It's www.reporthatepdx.com.
Okay.
And there's also the Oregon Department of Justice also has a bias response hotline. That would be 1-844-924-BIAS. And that's another place that we've been also looking to in terms of reported hate crimes against Asian Americans over the last few months?
Well, it looks like people have been so interested in what you've been saying that they have been reticent to call in, which does happen sometimes, and it usually is because they're just wanting to hear more. Because we haven't heard that much. And as you say, maybe it's also because you all have been just sort of taking care of your own business. But I really appreciate your coming on and sharing some of these stories with us. It's always important to get broader perspective for those of us who don't necessarily have that knowledge or maybe that daily experience. Because we are something of a segregated city, like all parts of the United States, most parts of the United States. And so, get out there and support those businesses. I'll give you the last word. We only have about a minute left. What are you looking to do as you go forward with your job as policy director at APANO?
Yeah, thank you, Paul. Yeah, I mean, honestly, I'm just feeling super inspired by the way that folks have been reaching out and wanting to support. I think the way that like different identities have been pitted against each other is kind of false, and I'm feeling like there's a lot of solidarity between all of our communities here in Portland fighting against sort of racial violence of any kind. So trying to hold some hope.
Right on. Well, best of luck, and reach out whenever you want to if you have anything that you're looking for a KBOO audience for people to support. I'd be glad to announce it. So thank you very much, Richa. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Paul.
Okay. This has been Paul Rowland talking with Richa Poudal of the APANO, Asian Pacific American Network of Oregon. Thanks to Sonia, my board operator, and keep on listening. Bye-bye, everybody.
Musicians in Solidarity is thrilled to announce this year's Sing Time Frolics Festival, online and real-time, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, March 26th through 28th, with guest artists Gordon Bach and